Lisa from New Jersey.
Hi, Lisa. How's it going?
Hey, good, thanks.
Good.
Tom from San Diego.
Who from San Diego?
Tom.
Tom, hi. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. Anybody else want to say hi?
Oh, hello.
Hello, who's it?
This is Louise. I'm calling from New Haven, Connecticut.
Hi, Louise.
Hi, who's this? Is this Jeremy?
This is Kim Aaliyah.
Oh, hi, Kim. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Yeah.
Oh, right. I met you at the Arizona conference there.
Oh, okay.
I actually drove you to the airport.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for that.
Okay, it was a while ago.
Who else is on who'd like to say hello?
This is Ellie in Santa Rosa.
Hi, Ellie. How's it going?
Hi.
I'm assuming it's nice weather down there because it's beautiful where I am.
It's starting to get warm, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I think. Good. Okay. Uh-oh.
So we're still waiting for Jeremy to join us, so we'll just talk amongst ourselves for a little bit.
Okay. Now, mine says my key is not present.
Hello, this is Bob Eklund.
Hey, Bob. How's it going?
Going pretty well.
Good.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Beautiful day here, so I'm happy. My wife's already out in the garden. So anybody else want to say hi?
Hello. Hi, I'm calling from Niagara Falls, Canada.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good. What's your name?
Julie Pacetto.
Hey, Julie. Oh, I know who you are, Julie.
Oh, is it Kim?
Yeah.
Hi, Kim.
Hey.
Yeah, we don't have the nice weather that you're having, though. It's raining here.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's okay. Hopefully those spring flowers will be blooming soon.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I'm actually looking out my window. My jasmine is starting to bloom already.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Sure. This is my first teleconference.
Oh, this is your first teleconference? Great.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm excited.
Oh, good. Yeah, this is going to be a great one.
Yeah.
It's a very knowledgeable and very, very eloquent speaker. Anybody else on who'd like to say hi?
Hi, Anna from Michigan.
Who from Michigan?
Anna Strong.
Hi, Anna. How are you?
Good.
Good.
How do I get this so that you don't pick up my background noise?
No, don't worry about it. I do that.
Oh, you do that. Okay.
Yeah, nobody has to worry about muting themselves. I'll be able to mute everybody else.
Okay, that's good.
At the appropriate time.
I think this is a great subject.
Yes, I think so. It's certainly a very important one, and one that people are oftentimes challenged by in their practices.
Yeah.
Kim, I haven't been, this is Nora, Dina. I haven't been listening to this teleconference. How often do you present, or who else is covering you?
Who else have we interviewed?
Pardon?
Are you asking who else we've had on these calls?
Right.
Oh, yeah, we had last call was Richard Pitt from the Pacific Academy of Homeopathic Medicine. And then before that, we had Roger Van Zandvoort. Prior to that, we had Frederick Schroyens, the editor of Synthesis. We had Ahmed Karim. We've had Will Taylor. We've had Farouk Master. We've had Paul Herskew. We've had Divya Shabra.
Luke DeShepper.
Lucas Shepard has done a number of them, and he's going to be doing the next one, I believe it's April 29th, and his are always excellent as well. So, yeah, these calls are a valuable way to expose some of our best teachers and best practitioners to the larger homeopathic community. Anybody else on who would like to say hello?
Hey, Jim.
Yes.
Jeremy, are you on yet?
I am.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, well, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, before we get started, I wanted to let you know, we do normally send out a quick email letting people know, because I'm going to introduce Jeremy, and one of the things about Jeremy is that he's a very prolific author, and we normally send out an email beforehand to let people know that they can get his books at discounted prices. I've asked Allison Burden to join us to just quickly let you know about those special offers. Allison, can you just share that quickly with everybody?
Sure. We're thrilled that Jeremy, who is a prolific author, is joining us today. I am going to have specials on all of Jeremy's books until May 7th. So contact me if you need to fill out your library with Jeremy's titles, and you can reach me toll-free at 866-599-5950, or you can inquire, call me at, contact me through our web, which is wholehealthnow.com/books.
Ta-da. Thanks, Allison.
Hi, there's a lot of background noise.
Okay, yeah, the number she said was, for people who want a discount on his books, it's 866-599-5950. You can contact her about that. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and mute everybody out now and then introduce Jeremy.
Can I ask a question first?
Sure, go ahead.
Where does the key go?
You know what? Why don't you call us at a later time?
Okay.
About that. Okay.
All right.
I'm
going to
mute everybody out at this point and introduce Jeremy. We're going to do this the same way that we always do, which is to have a formal interview for about 45 minutes, and then the latter part of the call, 15 to 20 minutes, maybe 25, we will open it up to general questions. Okay, so hold on one second. Okay, Jeremy, can you hear me?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine. You're not on a headphone or anything, are you?
No.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
All right, so first of all, thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule, Jeremy, to join us. Jeremy is calling in from England at this time, and it's kind of a little later in the day there. I've had the good fortune to know Jeremy now for, I'd say, personally for 4 or 5 years, and on top of being one of the most knowledgeable practitioners in homeopathy, he's also a very gifted teacher. And his contributions to homeopathy are really quite unbelievable. He's done over 20 provings, and I believe in contemporary homeopathy, he's done more provings than any other individual, including such important remedies like plutonium nitricum, chocolate, hydrogen, scorpion. He's also produced videos that describe some of these provings and the materia medica of some of these remedies. He's also the author of The Dynamics and Methodology of Homeopathic Provings, which has become pretty much a standard textbook in most colleges and schools worldwide. And he's also the author of two other books on provings, Dynamic Provings Volume 1 and Dynamic Provings Volume 2. And if you've ever had a chance to see Jeremy speak, it's an amazing experience because he has the ability to integrate various disciplines together, various fields, both from the classics, the organon, to contemporary ideas, in an almost magical manner. And if you ever talk to anybody who's been to one of his courses or one of his lectures, they'll tell you it's a profound experience. It's something where you, after one of his classes, you walk away feeling rejuvenated, reinvigorated, and completely astounded and amazed about this system that we call homeopathy. So thank you, Jeremy, so much for joining us on this call. It's a real great pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you, Kim. That's very kind.
Okay, so the title of today's...
Have we got some people out there, Kim?
I'm sorry, say it again, Jeremy.
Have we got some people out there?
Oh, there's a lot of people on the call, yep.
Well, hi there, people. Nice that you came to join us today.
They can't respond to you, but at the end, I'll open it up and let them say thank you at the very end of the call, okay?
Okay.
So, Jeremy, the topic of the call is the challenge of case management, and I just thought we could start with just a general question. Why is case management so important? And maybe even going a little bit further, there's this whole issue about, the one similimum, the one remedy for life, and how do you feel about that relative to this whole general idea of case management?
Okay, well, I'm pleased you asked me about that because it is one of my favorite subjects that I kind of go on about. Because I think case management is a huge issue in homeopathy, very important for anybody practicing. And in a way, it does sometimes stand in a contradiction or a paradox to this issue of the one remedy for life. Because if the case is that there's one remedy for life, we give a person that remedy, well, they should be better forever, or at least for a long time with some repetition. And there shouldn't be a big issue about case management at all. Whereas the moment we say case management, then naturally we're thinking there's going to be some changing around or, meandering along, not so smooth and easy as it appears in the beginning. So let's actually start with this issue of one remedy for life, which is something that every homeopath is going to ask and come across this dilemma or question at some stage in their career, usually somewhere around the second year, and it goes on for a long time. Is there one remedy for life? You'll find schools of thought that are adamant about this, and you'll find people that are changing remedies every week or in some cases even more. So I think the answer is, as usual, somewhere in between these two. Most of the cases that I see, when you look at the pattern of the case, it's quite clear to see that this person has had a pattern that has gone on for their whole lifetime. Even from conception, and if you want to Maybe it's been there a few lifetimes. And they just keep repeating the same pattern. If it's love, disappointment, and grief, if it's inability to succeed, if it's hesitation in front of obstacle, whatever their pattern is, both physical, mental, and emotional, it just goes on like a broken record again and again and again. And when they come to you as a patient and you put all this together and you make the connections and you analyze the case and you synthesize the case, hopefully you are going to perceive that thread, what is to be cured in the patient. And if we are good and lucky, then we will find one remedy that covers that whole issue, a remedy that they have needed their whole life. So from that point of view, we can say, yes, they need one remedy for life. However, and here comes the big however, what comes after they've received that remedy? Because after they receive that remedy, you would hope that that remedy would cure the issue that they came with, whatever it is, the grief, the love, disappointment, the hesitation, should eventually vanish with 1, 2, 3, 4 doses of the remedy, a repetition over a period of time. Otherwise, you know, what are we doing? Hopefully we are achieving something, and hopefully they're going to come back within 6 months or a year or 2 or 3 and say, you know what, I don't have that problem anymore. Now we come to a new stage, and at that stage, hopefully there will be some new picture to prescribe on eventually, because if we just go on with the same remedy all the time, what are we actually achieving? So hopefully once they've graduated from class 101, they'll go to class 102, to the next lesson that they have to learn. Really, what homeopathy is doing is it's just speeding up time. It's speeding up the lessons that they are learning. Instead of learning the lesson over 5 lifetimes, they learn it in 2 years, or they learn it in 6 months. So now, once they've had the remedy, eventually, after a period of time, that susceptibility should be fulfilled, and they will need a different remedy. Now, I know there's some people out there that say, oh, you know, you should be giving that same remedy for at least 5 years. But this is not my experience, not Hahnemann's experience, not Kent's experience. And I believe most practitioners I talk to, it is not their experience. The experience is that at some stage, after they've had the remedy, even the best of remedies, sometimes after 1 year, 5, 10 years, it doesn't matter, time is a flexible thing, that remedy is going to change. So I agree there's one remedy to life if we agree that life is until they've had that remedy, until the susceptibility has been fulfilled. After that, we get into something called the second prescription. You still with me, Kim?
Yeah, I'm with you.
You hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
So after that, we get into the second prescription. And this is really where I see the whole art of homeopathy and, you know, the most delicate part, the most subtle part, because, of course, you can go in many directions in the second prescription, but some will be better than others, and our aim is to go deeper and deeper into the case, curing more and more profound levels until we reach the very depth of Sora. And that is a huge part of case management, i.e. the second and all follow-up prescriptions. So when we take, for instance, the main book on case management is chronic disease from Hahnemann. Chronic means long-term, time. How do we manage this case long-term? Well, part one is understanding, following up, understanding, moving from one remedy to another, when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate, how to do it, what remedies follow well, all these very subtle aspects of the second prescription are a more sophisticated part of homeopathy. Most of the time, especially in school, we occupied with finding that first remedy. A lot of seminars concentrate on the first remedy because by nature, it's difficult to show a long-term case in a seminar, a case that's been going on for 5 to 10 years, to 15 years even. But when we are doing that in practice, then it's quite important to learn where those changes are, timing and direction of the second prescription. So that is one aspect of case management. There are other aspects as well, such as removing obstacles to cure, which is very important, knowing how to handle potency, knowing how to keep the patient coming, knowing how to deal with acutes, knowing how to progress along the path of miasms, and many other aspects. So if we look at paragraph 3, which, you know, is the kind of opening paragraph in the Organon to this whole issue, you can divide that paragraph into two. The first part says, find the remedy and the patient will get better. There's no doubt that if you find the right remedy, the patient will get better. However, the second part says, if you manage the case well, if you know how to choose potency, decide when to repeat the remedy, know how to change the remedy, remove obstacles to cure, motivate the patient, work along with the patient for a long, long time, deal with miasms, everything else, then the patient will remain better. And that is the difference between these two. Finding the similimum, the holy grail that most homeopaths are running after, will get the patient better. The question is, will they remain better, and how deeply better will they become on this path of cure? So, you know, I think this is an issue that comes up once somebody's been practicing for a year or two, once they go over that phase one of just finding the first remedy for the person. Okay, I hope that answers that issue partially. Kim?
Yeah, Jeremy, thank you. You know, to me, this is really the issue. I mean, what you said about it being the art of homeopathy, I don't remember if it was Kent, but I think it was Kent who said something like the first prescription in homeopathy is kindergarten, that the difficulty of a homeopathy is long-term case management over a period of years. And I think this is what I've always really appreciated about your classes, is that you really get down to the art of homeopathy, the long-term case management of really curing the patient. And so I really want to acknowledge you for that answer. It's just, it's really right on and really what people need to learn if they're going to be effective in their practices.
Thank you. You know, I agree. I feel that it's so important. And that's why in my school, a third of the school, you know, we do one-third philosophy, one-third materia medica, and one-third practical. And the practical, for me, is important because it is seeing the case over the long term. So what we do when we do live cases or video link cases is to see the patient from the beginning of the course over 3 or 4 years with all the follow-ups. And I know my students have seen in many, many cases how, you know, we do great with a patient, first remedies, you know, a lot of the time it's good. And there comes a stage after a year and a half, 2 years, where we say, okay, that remedy's been working. We've gone up in potency. We've gone down in potency. We've tried it in every different combination, and now it's stopped working. And there are some issues that are left over or some new issues that have come. And where do we go from here? What is the changeover?
Sure, sure. This is really it.
So, you know, it has to be seen in practice and in theory. To learn a second prescription, most of that data is very well written in the organ and on the second prescription, actually, and also in Kent's lectures and Kent's letter writings. But it's very confusing stuff to read on the second prescription. I remember, you know, reading Kent and Hahnemann on that and coming out quite confused because I think the big problem was that those guys didn't have a word processor. You know, so they weren't able to index it, catalog it, arrange it neatly, put it all in a nice way. And that has to be done, and then you see that actually there's no paradoxes or contradiction. It's all fairly clearly laid out.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So Jeremy, in general, how long do you find, I know it will vary from patient to patient, but how long do you find it takes to really cure a patient?
You know, if a patient came in and said, you know, how long would it take for me to get cured? And we were obliged to tell them the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, we would be in trouble. Because to cure the patient really at the depth of cure, I think would take many, 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 many years. But that depends on our definition of cure. And that definition is way beyond what the patient is thinking when they come to us with a hay fever or even a diabetes or a cancer or whatever it is. They want the primary symptoms to vanish. But a homeopath, looking at the chronic disease issue, looking at the long and deep term, knows that that person would like that person to be better into the depth of sorrow, right into the roots of the very disease that we are carrying. And that is a long way to go. So, you know, we could say, maybe it's better to say that cure is a process, cure is a journey, rather than a destination. And it really very much depends on our definition. So, you know, I think if we ask, if we take this to a bigger level and we say, you know, when will the world be cured? When will there stop being famine and wars and AIDS and strife and difficulties and infections and malarias and problematic marriages and all that kind of stuff? I mean, that's a big question, and we can't sit there asking that with every patient. But in the end, where do we want to go with homeopathy? What do we really want to achieve? Because, you know, Hanuman's problem that he faced in chronic disease was, what is cure really? How come I cure all these people? And 10 years later, they're back. And that's when he started to think, you know, there's something deeper here. There's something that really needs to change on a much deeper and bigger scale. And if we go to that bigger totality, we say, cure, that's a long time maybe. But if we stick to the totality of the patient and, you know, just the symptoms that they want, well, that is quite different with every case. And, you know, usually you can kind of, once you find the right remedy, then you can maybe give an assessment of the answer. So, you know, in a case of eczema, maybe it'll be 6 months or 2 years, but that's already on an individual basis.
Sure, sure. Jeremy, maybe you could just share, what are some of the factors that are involved in good case management?
Okay, well, it's like this. It starts off with letting, exactly from the question you just asked, how long does it take to cure a patient? You know, when they come and they say, how long is it going to take? My aim is to keep them with me as long as possible. It doesn't have to actually be with me. It has to be with homeopathy. But once I've got them in the web of homeopathy, I want them to stay there because of what I just said. I know that the real cure to the depth of their soul, to the roots of the disease, that is a long and careful business, not just the eliminating of the first symptoms. So my aim is to have them there and have them stay for the duration. It's like Ken said, those patients who really know what they're looking for, who really want a long-term deep change in their whole inner state, they will be the best patients to work with. And most patients won't hang around that long. So the first thing in case management is to say to them, you know, look, I want to, you know, maybe we can help you quite quickly, but I'd really like to work with you for a long time to achieve really good results. And, you know, I'd rather see this progress slowly and carefully than to see any kind of magic immediate change which might not last. Whatever it is, any kind of motivational sentence that you can make up to say, you know, hang around in here. Let's work on this. Let's go in this for the long term. Let's do this journey together. Because that's where you'll achieve the really deep results. If they come for the one-pill wonder, you know, you might do some magic with them, and that's great, and it's nice to see always, and very impressive. But, you know, my aim is to keep them there. So stage one, motivate them to stay with you. Stage two, of course, find the remedy. Stage three, the best remedy that they need at the moment. You know, watch out for having good contact with them, you know, at the right kind of time. Not too often, because that can be problematic if they get emotionally dependent on you and need to phone in all the time, and you get tempted into changing a remedy too easily, and not too difficult to get hold of either, you know, but just have a good regular contact so that, you know, I find in an average chronic case, every 4 to 6 weeks is nice. You have a regular chat with them. That's a good kind of timing on a regular case. And in that, managing the case also means keep motivating them and keep helping them to stick it out. Now, then you'll come to the issue of the follow-up second prescription that we mentioned before, which hopefully over the years that they'll be with you, there might be a few changes like that. And the aim is with each new remedy to go deeper and deeper and deeper into the roots of the disease, not going around in circles. That's the problem, you know. Sometimes a second prescription looks easy, but then you find that you've gone around in a circle rather than going deeper. Then there's removal of obstacles to cure. And in that, there are two issues in obstacles to cure. The first is timing. If a person comes to you and they are smoking, and you say to them, you know, look, I'm not going to treat you until you stop smoking, or you have to start smoking before you take the remedy, or stop the coffee, or stop the heroin, or break up your marriage that's not working, or whatever it is that's an obstacle, they won't be able to do it. And you're asking too much of them, and they're not going to hold it out because they're not ready. You have to change, help them change inside before you remove the obstacle. But if they come back 2 months later, 6 months later, they are a lot better, things have changed, and you perceive, okay, this is a time that you can remove this obstacle. Now they're ready to stop smoking. Now they're ready to make a change in their life, in their job, in their diet, or whatever it is. So it's a matter of really being alert for timing. When is the right point to actually pick that obstacle and it's going to come off real easy? Like when you say to them, okay, I think you should give up smoking now. I think it's time. And they say, you know what? It's going to be difficult, but you're right. I can do it now. And then you know you've hit it at the right moment. Whereas if they, you know, you say stop smoking and they start screaming and screeching and squirming, you know it's too early. It's premature. They can't handle it. So timing is one. And the other thing is knowing how to remove them. You know, it's how you tell them, how you make them come to that point where they want to do it themselves. And that involves a little bit of, you know, careful wording, a touch of NLP, a touch of homeopathic speech, timing, you know, inserting suggestions into them. And that whole route of removing the obstacles is so very important, because we have to remember there are naturopaths who get people better just by removing obstacles. And this is part of what being a homeopath is about. So we can achieve, even if we don't find the magic remedy, achieve great results with removing, but it's the how and the when of removing that is the issue. So that's another issue in management. Another issue in management is knowing how to deal with all these little acute problems that happen in between. There may be a real acute disease. There may be a fever of some kind, the infection. How to deal with aggravations. How to deal with stronger dissimilar diseases, which means some random nasty event that happens to the patient, i.e. they, happen to be in a bus that hits the wall and they have an accident. And it's supposedly got nothing to do with their susceptibility. Although, of course, there'll be one school of thought that says everything that happens to the person is part of their susceptibility and they ordered that from the universe. And another school of thought that will say it's a random accident. Nevertheless, we have to know how to deal with that. Do we change the remedy? Do we give them arnica? Do we give them whatever remedy it is? What happens if that person is doing really well on your remedy, and then suddenly the firm goes bankrupt and they're without a job? You know, is this prescribable? Is this not prescribable? That is all dealing with what we call stronger dissimilar disease, random events from the outside that knock the patient out of their track. And that is another issue of long-term case management. Then there's epidemics that might be happening. And then finally, there's the whole miasmatic issue, which is how to go long-term into the depth of the case. So I'd say those are the main issues, Kim.
Yeah, I mean, this is homeopathy in the trenches, Jeremy. That's really what it's all about. Since you mentioned miasms there at the end, you know, it seems there's so many different opinions about miasms and what they are and even the definition of them, and now there's people who are talking about more than the traditional 3 or 4, even 5 miasms. Now they're talking about 10 miasms. Could you just maybe give us a little bit of your opinion about miasms and how you see them and how you use them in your practice?
Okay, I'll begin by saying that I think that miasms are not a useful concept for those in the early school and very early practice. So if there are people out there, you know, in their first, second, third year, first year of practice, it often happens that people study miasms and at the end of it they say, well, what do I do with this? This is just confusing me. It's not helping me. It's not getting me anywhere. And I think that's right. In the beginning of practice, it's just confusing. Where mindfulness becomes useful is once you've been going for a while and you've seen that case for 3 years, for 10 years, and you're starting to think, am I really getting anywhere? Is this going deeper into cure, or am I just going round and round? And that's where the miasmatic question comes up, and that's exactly what happened to Hanuman. I mean, miasms is a concept he came up with in, you know, he started thinking about it in 1816. He'd been practicing for 20 years, and when he started to see those cases for 20 years, the question arose. Now, in order to really go to the source of what miasms are about, well, we have to go to Hanuman, because he's the dude that said, you know, the word miasms in homeopathy, so we might as well start from him. And that means some paragraphs in the Organon and Chronic Disease, which is not an easy book. I love that book, but, you know, it needs to be studied carefully and deeply. So if we start from there, then we'll have a good root in what miasms really mean and where they come from, rather than starting from the very interesting and many new approaches to miasms, that they are not necessarily always connected to the root of the issue, to what Hanuman meant by miasms. It doesn't mean they're not good ideas, but are we talking about the same thing? One of the things that, just as you mentioned, Kim, that about miasms that is amusing is that every teacher who talks about miasms says something slightly different. You never hear two people saying the same thing. So that is not... Actually, we can take that as a symptom, as the key to understanding what that miasm thing really is about. How come there are 100, 200, 1,000 homeopaths each saying something different about one issue? That is actually a reflection of the miasm itself, because in its deep aspect, what I understand that Hanuman was saying about Sora is, how come there are 6 billion people in the planet, and each one of them is saying something different. Each one of them has a different aspect of truth or a different delusion, and which makes everybody fight each other in one way or another and forget that they actually all belong to one, all belong together. This is, you know, where Hanuman, I understand, was really going with miasm, saying, how come everybody's just like a fragmented individual opposite a big whole totality that is connected to its source and makes it one happy human race? Okay, that's a bit esoteric. So let's go back, you know, and to my understanding that what Hanuman meant by Sora. But we know that Hanuman perceived 3 main miasms. Now, in his miasms, he calls these chronic miasms. Miasms are an issue about chronic disease. And therefore, really, they can only belong to chronic diseases, not to acute diseases. So syphilis is a deep chronic disease, gonorrhea is a deep chronic disease, all kinds of scabies are deep chronic disease. That's what he was focusing on, how to go to the bigger picture, not to smaller pictures, not to acute disease or epidemics or infections. However, to my mind, the big issue about miasms is this. Most people feel that miasms are a gimmick for finding a remedy. They say, oh, you know, if we study this miasm thing, that will help us find the similimum. And to my mind, that's not what Hanuman meant at all. And in fact, he says so quite clearly in the Organon. He says, these miasms are not going to help you find the similimum. I mean, if we've got 3 miasms, that doesn't help us much in finding a similimum. I mean, it's like saying, you know, is the patient hot or cold? Not usually a great help in finding the similimum. It kind of divides the world into 2, and there's some people that can be hot and cold, so, you know. And another thing about it is, anyway, anybody can't agree what miasm the case is. If I ask a class of students, what miasm do you think that case was? They'll get 40% saying syphilis, 40% psychosis, 10% Sora, and 10% say we don't care. So, you know, it's not really a practical help in finding a remedy. But that's not what Hanuman intended it for. Hanuman intended it as a map to navigate long-term treatment, a map to know if you are on Highway 66 or Highway 90. Are you progressing along the road of Sora? Are you progressing along the road of syphilis or psychosis? It gives you a general direction, but it does not actually say to you, you know, this is the next remedy that you have to give. I mean, if the person's syphilitic, you can choose between 200 syphilitic remedies that you can give them. It's not got you very far. But it does tell you, okay, I'm proceeding along this highway, and that is the path that I'm going to be taking for a while, using syphilitic remedies. So that's my some of my basic understanding about miasms. But as I said to you, you know, miasms are so difficult in practice for people because in philosophy, as you said, and I agree, everybody disagrees. Everybody's got a different take. If it comes to cases, as I just said, everybody has a different take. You know, I've seen it so many times in classes that it's very seldom that everybody gets up and says, yes, this is psychosis. Usually you get kind of 50-50-50. And then how are we going to know about these miasms? And that's why, you know, in my book about syphilis, what I did there was a kind of investigation into the nature, at least, of syphilis by saying, okay, the purest form of data that we have about the syphilitic miasm is actually in the materia medica. In remedies that we know are syphilitic, remedies like mercury, like aurum, like syphalinum, and others that are like 100% syphilitic, platina, for instance. So what I did is I took all those remedies, tried to analyze each one of them and understand them as best as I could, and then look for the common denominator running between all those remedies. And in that way, looking for the thread that defines a syphilitic miasm. Because philosophy is a contentious issue, cases are contentious, so I found that pure materia medica was a nice direct route into it, and I came to my conclusions about what syphilis is about. But that's another story. So, my bottom line is what I'm saying here is, to understand miasms, you know, first, don't worry about it in the early stages. Once you're ready for it, start off with the base, chronic disease, and the organon, because that's where it is. And then understand that it's not always a gimmick for finding a remedy, but more a way to know how and where you are progressing into the case. And when you are going to change a remedy from a syphilitic highway to a psoriatic highway, for instance.
Thank you for that answer, Jeremy. I personally want to just also thank you personally for the syphilis book that you wrote, because it is a unique book in homeopathy in terms of its not only of its description of syphilis, but I think you've balanced the left and right brain approaches in that book in a way that's unique in homeopathy. So I want to personally thank you for that book. It's been one book that's really helped me to understand that miasm in a much deeper and more profound manner. So thank you personally for that.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we'll be talking about here is acute versus chronic. And one question that comes up for a lot of people is, can you use acute remedies in chronic states, or can you use chronic remedies in acute states? What is your position on this?
Okay. You know, it's quite in fashion today to say that there's no such thing as acute or chronic remedies, or that you can have a chronic belladonna and a chronic aconite and a chronic stramonium, and that any remedy goes for anything. Now, I both agree and disagree. In what way? That can you have a case that is belladonna and has been belladonna all their life? Absolutely. I mean, we've all seen that case of, you know, stramonium that has been a stramonium since the day they were born, or an aconite, or whatever other acute remedy of the many that we have. So we know that a person can need these acute remedies for their whole life. But just as I said before, once they've had that remedy, is this going to finish the case? And it's my understanding that no way. Meaning, that stramonium is never going to finish a case. It might cure the person from the ailments that they had all their life. Maybe they were born with fright and with violence and with abuse and with dogs and whatever it is. And they've had that this lifetime and I don't know if last lifetime. And you give them the stramonium and all that goes away and it's magic and you say, here's my constitutional stramonium. That's great. However, that does not mean that the case is finished, that the case is cured. That's where we come into saying, okay, Now, what was the kind of ground that that stramonium grew on? How come it was able to grow so fertily? You know, there's something underneath there. There's a chronic disease, a miasm, a syphilis, a psychosis, a sora, whatever it is, and we are going to have to go there, and we have to go to remedies that eventually can go deeper into the case, because there are remedies that are different depths in terms of their action, in terms of the totality they can address, in terms of the length of action, and eventually we'll be wanting to go to those deeper remedies. So, yes, it can be a constitutional remedy, but it's not the end of the story. And vice versa, you know, can we cure acute states with chronic remedies? Can a person come with an acute high fever, a meningitis, and maybe they need a sulfur calcarea? Or what's more common today is people say, give their constitutional remedy, so to speak, during the acute. Now, to my mind, no, I prefer during acute to give an acute, and during a chronic to give a chronic, providing it's a real acute. And here, just as an aside, we have to differentiate between a real acute and an acute exacerbation of a chronic, but let's leave that for the moment. Another point in case management. So back to real acutes. And real acutes, which are characterized by an exciting cause, usually a fever, a crisis of some kind, and then either death or recovery, they are going to need a remedy. But in homeopathy, we don't just match symptoms, we match pace. Now, the pace of sulfur calcarea is not the case of hyoscyamus belladonna, stramonium, simisifuga, veratrum, arsenicum, which are the more acute remedies. And we want to match the pace, the suddenness of the onset, the quickness, the high fever. Usually, acute, fast-acting remedies will address that issue better. And Hahnemann himself says that acute disease and chronic disease are totally opposing forces. They are not only dissimilar, they are actually opposite. They work in opposite directions. So when a person gets a true acute, I'll go for the acute remedy. And when they're back to the chronic, I'll go for the chronic remedy. That's how I understand it from Hahnemann and Kent, and that's what my logic tells me as well, because they are so diametrically opposite. However, coming back to the case management issue of acute exacerbations of the chronic, and let me give an example here to make it clear. This is not your sudden one-time fever after the infection. This is your asthma, which is quiet and subordinate, you know, you don't see it, and then suddenly, you know, every Wednesday you get an asthma attack, and next Wednesday asthma attack, or migraine, or premenstrual tension. Any of these things that are a recurring chronic theme that just have the acute spikes, that is a different issue. And here, better to deal with it with the chronic remedy, not necessarily during the spikes, but, you know, during the quiet time in between. So here I'm back to another issue that maybe I didn't emphasize on case management, Kim, that is, you know, knowing how to classify disease, how to classify what's happening during the evolution of a case. Are we in an acute or real acute? Are we in an acute exacerbation? You know, as I mentioned, maybe it's an epidemic. Maybe this person went to a third world country and got hit by a cholera or even got hit by a flu at home or something like that. That's a different way of handling it. So first of all, we need to classify kind of where does this disease fall into, and then treat appropriately. So to answer your question, I think acute disease, acute remedies most likely. Chronic disease, chronic remedies most likely. We may see acute that spans the whole life of the patient, but once they've had a few doses of that over 6 months, a year, 2 years, there's going to come a time when we're going to have to go deeper into the case.
Thank you, Jeremy. You know, one of the issues that a lot of people have questions about, you know, in the sixth edition of the Organon Hahnemann talks about LMs, and it seems that a lot of people read the sixth edition but pretty much practice from the fourth edition like Kent did. Could you give us a little bit of an idea of how you would use LMs, or do you use them, and, you know, and how does that relate to long-term case management?
Well, I quite like LM potencies. You know, I probably use them in 40 or 50% of my practice. And But my game in regards to potency is I use everything. I use anything from my tincture to a 50M, a MM, a LM, a 12C, a 15C, a 60C, a 150C. You know, I use the whole range, and I try to fit the potency for the patient because, to my mind, the potency is part of the prescription. It needs to match the patient as best as possible. Now, LMs are just another potency. Then there's nothing magic about them or different about them. They're a different scale. But the reason I like them is there are certain circumstances where I feel it's appropriate to repeat the remedy daily or every 2 days or three times a day, depending on the case. And in those cases, my main issue is that it's important to plus the remedy, as Hanuman said, which means to change the level of stimulus all the time. The main thing is when you're repeating daily, you want to be changing that stimulus. Otherwise, they get used to it and people stop noticing it, like any stimulus, you know. If somebody hassles you the same hassle every day, like saying, clean your room, clean your room, clean your room, and then you're not going to hear it unless they change the level of stimulation. The LMs are a convenient way of changing the level of stimulation, simply because the pharmacies send them out in liquid form and in a dropper bottle, and it's easy to regulate and to manage the case through that. Also, an issue of managing the case. Absolutely. Sometimes too much aggravation, you dilute them more, you do more succussions, less succussion, all those ways of regulating it. So, to sum up here, the LM is just another scale of potency. I use it when I need to repeat remedies frequently. When do I need to repeat remedies frequently? Mainly when there's heavy pathology and obstacles to cure. The more pathology, the more obstacles to cure, the more I will tend to repeat, because that case is stuck and it needs shifting. Now, if I'm just going to give the remedy for 2 weeks, then a 12C is fine with me. But once you go over that 2 weeks, you have to be changing the stimulation. And there the LMs are useful. Now, some people advocate giving the 12C in liquid and plusing it on that level, and I think that's just great, that's fine. It's only that the pharmacies don't usually do it from that, you know, so not every pharmacy supplies 12C in liquid. But the main game is just upping it all the time to keep the level of stimulus up. Now, usually with LMs, you'll be giving it for a month, you'll be giving it for 2 months. If the remedy is good, then, you know, and it's working well, that's fine. You'll come to a point where it will either stop working or you'll get aggravation. What often happens with LM is that the aggravation comes at the end. And the reason is, partly because it's being repeated daily, and to a degree, each day you give it, it's antidoting the day beforehand while still stimulating the patient. They also have a different wave of action. So often you'll give LMs for 2 months, suddenly the patient gets aggravation. I stop, give them a rest for a week. It's always good to give the patient a rest when you're repeating daily, not to go on and on and on and on and on, because they just lose their sensitivity to the whole issue of stimulation. So I stop, I let them rest, and then I go up either one potency or two potencies. If it's been under a month and a half, I'll go up one potency. If it's over 2 months, I'll go up two potencies, because by that time you've probably succussed wanes from the LM2 all the way into the LM3, so I'll increase it by a bit more. Otherwise, I say, you know, if you're starting off, play around, try different potencies, go high, go low, see what it does, find out for yourself, because the truth is nobody knows that much about it out there, and you really need to find out for yourself. So these things, you know, no laws, just find out for yourself what works and experiment with the different potencies. I know for myself, you know, in my first year in practice, I just gave the 30C, only 30, nothing else. Second year, I just gave the 200. Third year, I gave 30, 200, 1M, just to find out what each potency does and play around with it.
Thanks, Jeremy. Now, I know, Jeremy, that you're going to be starting a course in Minnesota, and I believe that's at the end of October 2004. I just wanted to let people know that if they want more information about that, it'll be in St. Paul, Minnesota. They can contact Denise Warkoff, and that's Warkoff at earthlink.net. That's W-A-R-K-O-V at earthlink.net. I'll repeat that again, Warkoff, W-A-R-K-O-V, at earthlink.net, and that's going to be starting in October of 2004. And I believe this is a three-year program, Jeremy, is that correct?
Yeah, it's a three-year program. It's my dynamics program. I'll be coming three times a year doing philosophy, materia medica, long-term cases, the whole dynamic program, and, you know, and hopefully having a lot of fun, which usually we do have.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard from a lot of people who have studied at various schools and then have afterwards gone and done this program or even have come as new students that they've gotten a tremendous amount out of it and that their ability to practice and understand homeopathy has reached really new levels. So I know personally from the classes that I sat in on, and I've been doing homeopathy now for 15 years, that I learned a tremendous amount. So I think this is something that what you're doing there is invaluable to the homeopathic community. I know you're involved in some other projects as well. Could you just share with us? I know you're very busy. Could you tell us just some of the other things that you're doing right now?
Sure, I'd love to. I do have a lot of projects, but the most exciting one, well, they're all exciting to me, and the big problem is I've only got 24 hours a day. So I need more time. The most exciting thing for the moment is something I've been dreaming about for a long time and speaking to my students about for a long time, and that is that I want to go out to Africa and treat AIDS and treat a lot of AIDS until I find, hopefully, with the help of my friends, a genus epidemicus remedy for AIDS. Because, you see, a lot of people are treating AIDS, and I've treated AIDS, and have good results, but everybody's treating cases one by one by one. Now, this is exactly where we come into chronic disease and the issue of epidemics, pandemics, you know, collective disease, and AIDS is a collective disease, as everybody knows. And I want to look at it that way, as a collective disease. And to do that, I need to go out there and see a lot of cases and see what hangs together and what makes them tick as one big totality and look at it from a different level rather than the just one by one level. The other thing I want to achieve here is if please God, you know, I can get some good results with the AIDS, I want to make this a research that is proper enough to go to the outside world and say, look, you know, homeopathy can achieve stuff here. And, you know, we are able to do things, and it's cheap, and it's effective, and there are no side effects. And this is the medicine of the future for this situation, so that to get things moving on a big level. So it's a big dream for me, and I've been thinking about it a long time, and I'm off to South Africa next week to check out clinical contacts. So, you know, if there's anything at the moment, I can't handle offers of people to come or to help. And, you know, why not do the same thing also if you want to? The more the merrier. But if you know any great clinical contacts in South Africa, in Africa, and if you know people with a lot of money who are looking for a good cause to sponsor this project, then great, let us know. So that's my most exciting project, and I'm really happy that this is beginning to happen. Other than that, I am writing, well, kind of, I should be writing a few books, but I don't get up early enough in the morning, but I am writing a piece of homeopathic software that is very different from the existing software, so it's not a competition with the existing software, but I hope it will be a great adjunct to the existing software. It's a kind of dynamics module, and that's nice. You know, I'm having fun doing that and spending a lot of money doing that as well. So, you know, I hope that will be out within the next 6 months or so.
Great.
And other than that, we're doing a nice little project with Homeopathic Symposium, actually, which is just doing a case together on the web, I believe, for the first time that people can watch where there's one case, and, you know, everybody can see the case on Homeopathic Symposium, and then I suggest a solution, and I listen to everybody's solutions and ideas too. And together we try to treat this case for a year and see if we can help this patient. And, you know, it's just a great way to educate and to learn together and to share. So, you know, we've just begun with this case. It will be, I believe it will be on the web soon. You can see it on...
It actually is on the web already.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
www.homeopathicsymposium.com, I think. Yes,
yeah.
It is. So check that out. That's a nice communal learning project, and I think there'll be other people. I think Roger Morrison is going to be doing one too, so that's exciting. And other than that, we're writing volume 3 of the provings. That my wife Camilla is doing work on that, and I should be writing a few other books, and the usual kind of things that one does.
Tim and Jeremy, Malcolm Smith here on the line, if I could just interject for a sec. With the Homeopathic Symposium, Jeremy's overseeing a really difficult case, and we're inviting everyone to write in your ideas for how to move forward with this case. And then Jeremy will host another conference call about a month from now, and we'll discuss with everyone the case. And then month by month, you can come back online and watch the follow-ups. And all of that is free for charge. You just have to register for the Homeopathic Symposium, and you can be a part of this first team effort case.
Great. Thanks, Malcolm.
No problem.
Guys. Okay, so I'm going to unmute the call and open it up to the general audience. Jeremy, thank you again. That was a wonderful discussion on a very difficult subject, and I know for those people who have an opportunity to study with in the future, they're going to get into the trenches with you and really learn the art of homeopathy, because that's really what it's all about. So let me open it up. I'm sure there's lots of questions, and 1 second. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hey, who do I know out there now? Any of my students?
Hi, Jeremy. It's Rowan.
Hi, Rowan. How are you doing, hon?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. Who else?
Hi, Jeremy. It's Mary Jo.
Hi, Mary Jo. How are you doing?
Great.
Okay. All these are all my Calopteryx people. That's dragonfly people. They did the proving of dragonfly, and I just got a wonderful gift from them, a beautiful dragonfly shadow box in the post today, so I'm very happy with that. Are there any other dragonflies out there? No, 2 dragonflies. Any sapphire people? No sapphires. Okay. So go ahead with your question, guys. Girls?
Jeremy, this is Paulette Bliss in St. Louis.
Hi, Paulette.
Hello. Do you have contacts in the South African government, in the ANC?
I have some contacts, but the more the merrier. I actually, there's a homeopathic member of parliament, a member of parliament who is also a homeopath, Dr. Ruth Rabinovich, and she's definitely helping on our side. And the more people, if you know anybody and have a great contact, put us in touch with them, and, you know, that can only help.
Yes. Well, I may be able to. Could you contact you?
Yes, absolutely. Just write to dynamis@dynamis.edu or check out my website, www.dynamis.edu.
Dynamis.edu.
Yeah, and you'll get my email there.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yeah, please.
Hi, this is Sherry Nacken. I'm in Wales.
Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Jeremy. With LM potencies, I like to use them, but I end up finding, I'm still quite new at it, finding that I'm micromanaging the case, which it's kind of like, you know, I'd like to let them go, but then I'm, you know, do 3 succussions, do 5 succussions. Any hints at how to get through that process?
Well, you see, in some ways, that's a useful thing, that's micromanaging, because it helps when a patient has a lot of issues and dependencies and little problems, and they need a constant contact, and they phone you one day and they say, my headache is a bit worse, or my toe aches, or I'm a bit depressed, and you're able to say to them, well, okay, you know what, instead of 1 drop, use 2 drops or something like that. It gives that level of ability to relate to them on that level of, okay, you can do something here, I'm going to give you a kind of little prescription. Whereas if you've given them a single dose 2 months ago and all you can say is wait, 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 that's quite difficult. So in those terms, actually the micromanagement is a good way of managing, of handling the case. But it can, as you say, it can get a bit tedious, and there you have to, you know, fit it to the kind of patients. If people get over anxious about it and they're phoning every day and wanting a change, then you have to just try and get them on a regular regime and say, you know, give them good instructions. One thing I'll say is this. With the LMs, give out a sheet with instructions and save yourself a lot of talking and telephoning. Make a sheet with very clear, nice instructions. Make sure you know what the pharmacy is sending or what you're giving, drop a bottle or teaspoons or all that way of doing it. And then that reduces the number of bothersome phone calls. I hope that helps.
It does. It's just that it seems like sometimes you lose the forest for the trees, you know, and...
That is the issue, and it is the problem with the LMs. And I'd say once in a while it's good to have a remedy holiday and just stop and let the case relax and see what happens. Let the relapse actually happen.
Okay.
Sometimes we're just pushing all the time, and it gets confusing, and you don't see the big picture. And
yeah.
Then, you know, say to them, stop the remedy and come and see me in 2 weeks, and let's see what's settled, what's happening.
Okay, that's a good idea. Thank you.
Okay, no problem. See, the problem with pushing and repeating the remedy all the time, you gain something and you're going to lose something too. And what you lose is that primary and secondary action of the remedy, the way it rises and it falls and it relapses. And there's a lot of good information in there. And sometimes, yes, you're absolutely right. We get into this hyper-managing of the case, and it can be bothersome. So less is more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yeah.
Yes.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Do you know of a good reference? I haven't really used LMs very much and would like a good reference to read more about them.
There is a book, I'm trying to remember who it's by, a little pamphlet that you can get from Helios Pharmacy. I'm sure the other homeopath, I'm sure. Kim, do you have something in Whole Health now?
Yeah, Jeremy, there's a couple of things. Probably the most comprehensive is Carol Cook's book, Little Miracles. She looked at the topic quite thoroughly when she was studying.
Right.
And after getting out into practice for a couple of years, she went over it and sort of finalized her ideas. And in that, she's amalgamated Barker's pamphlet where he looked at...
Right, that was Barker, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's Chowdhury's one from India.
Yeah.
That is Festi Melesmo, but we carry Chowdhury's and Carol Cook's, and that's probably the most up-to-date.
That'll do it. That's a good start. There's one thing I'll add to that. You know, use that as a starter, but
yeah.
I think both, I don't know, at least Chowdhury's book and Barker's book, they say always start with kind of LM1 and work your way up, if I recall correctly. And that's okay for the beginning, but after a while, you know, you don't have to start with LM1. You can start with LM2 or 5 or 7 or 10 or 12, whatever you want, realizing that, you know, anything above the 10 is already quite a high potency. But there's no law that says you can just start with LM1 or that you only have to go, you know, from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. You can jump potencies. You can go back. You can go forward because the name of the game is stimulation. And the name of the game is varying the stimulation just the least needed to keep that patient moving forward. So play around, experiment.
Right.
Question of switching from LM to, I'm Krishna, Jeremy.
Yes, hello.
Yes. So I'm from England. Actually, I was practicing there, but now I'm in the States.
Okay.
Yes, I just was asking that when to switch from LM to the, like other potencies, is there any indication sometimes the case becomes stationary after LM? So can we go to those other potencies like C30, C200, 1M, 10M?
Absolutely, yeah, I agree with your point. Sometimes you'll be giving the LM and it stops working, it stops happening, and the level of stimulation isn't happening enough, or on the contrary, you might find that they're actually doing so well, you don't need to keep pushing the LM. And I don't find any big problem going for, you know, from giving them LM2 or for a few months and then saying, okay, stop, I'm going to give one dose of the 30 and see where that goes and how that works. Because I'm changing a level of stimulation and that might work quite well. So I'll skip scales between the the LM and between the synthesimal, whatever. It's like playing jazz. You can't play one scale only.
Great.
Jeremy, I have a question.
Yeah?
When Kent's book, the section on the second prescription is quite clear, but I've also always appreciated your ability to just call up aphorisms at will. In the Organon, where specifically does Hahnemann address the second prescription?
In between paragraph, let's say, 157 and 184.
Perfect.
So let's take it to you know, a bit of a broader view of this, because just giving numbers is boring.
Mm-hmm.
The Organon, once it gets to paragraph 71, it divides into three. And it's the three main issues in homeopathy. The first part is what needs to be cured in the case, i.e., you know, understanding disease, taking the case, and that is between paragraph 72 and 101. So you've got that whole chunk of Organon which is about the case, the person. After that, you've got a whole chunk of Organon from 102 to about 100 and, I guess, 40s, 41, 42, which is about understanding materia medica, i.e. what is curative in our remedies. And after that is the whole chunk which goes from there, from 140s till the end, which is about adapting one to the other, about how to match one to the other. And that's where we get into strange rare and peculiar, treating acute diseases, treating epidemics, and the issue of the second prescription, which stretches over those paragraphs.
Thank you so much.
Okay, pleasure.
Why don't we have one more question? We're getting close to the end of our time.
I'm happy to go for a few more minutes, Kim.
Okay, let's have three more. Let's have 40 more questions. No.
Okay.
Let's have three more questions.
So.
I have a question.
Hello.
Hello, it's Mary Lee. I'm in Canada.
But I hear a South African accent.
I do, yes. I am from South Africa originally.
Okay.
But I'm practicing now in Canada.
Right.
I have been in touch with some doctors in India, and they are using an approach where they are using the nosode at a deep level when you get the nosodal picture.
Mm-hmm.
In chronic cases, and people give one or two doses at a very high attenuation.
Yes.
With the idea of killing the deep miasmic picture, and I would like to know your ideas on this.
Okay, I think it's sometimes appropriate and sometimes less so. The idea comes in a way from saying, well, the nosode equals the miasm. You have psora, you give psorinum. You have syphilis, you give syphilinum. But I think that is not necessarily the case or not always the case, meaning you can be extremely syphilitic and oral might be the remedy that will go deep, deep, deep into the case, deep into the miasm. You know, I consider mercury a more syphilitic remedy even than syphilinum. So there is a school of thought that says nosode equals miasm, but I say, you know, the way I understand it, that a group of remedies equals miasm, meaning all the syphilitic remedies equal the totality of syphilis. All the psoric remedies equal the totality of psora. And each one is indicated according to its symptomatology at the right time. So, you know, if I think the case is in its depth of psora, it may be psorinum, yes, but it may actually be more calcarea or more magnesia or alumina, whatever's appropriate according to the symptoms. However, that approach could be useful if you come to that place in the case where there's absolutely no symptoms and you're sitting there for 6 months, you've treated the case, they've done really well, and you just don't know where it's going anymore because there's such a paucity of symptoms. But then, and you know it's a sore case, so you say, well, maybe I'll go in with psorinum. But it may also be sulfur that will trigger it as well. So I use it I don't use that approach so much myself, but I'm sure at times it can be useful.
Another question?
Yes, one question, Jeremy. That about these nosodes, they say don't use them in the lower potencies. Always it is better to use them in C200, 1M, 10M. Is it there anything like that?
I don't subscribe to that thought, because to me, like on the previous question, a nosode is just a remedy. I do not see a fundamental difference between a nosode and between any other remedy. So for Lionem, it's just a remedy. I'm more scared of taking arsenic low potency than taking sulfalinum low potency, to be honest. I mean, I wouldn't relish the thought of sulfalinum mother tincture, but I'd have that before I had arsenic mother tincture. So no, I've given carcinosin in LM1 and low potencies of sulfalinum and sulfalinum and everything. I think a nosode is just like any other remedy in its nature. And you can repeat it, and you can give it in LMs, and you can go up, and you can go down. Free fall.
One final question.
Okay, I have a question. Jeremy, if you give a remedy and you see the patient is overstimulated, just from experimenting with myself, and some homeopaths say not to do this, but if I go lower in dose, I say, oh, that's so much better. I feel so much better. And can you speak on that a little bit?
So when you say overstimulated, you mean they had a bad aggravation or something?
I'm speaking from myself.
Yeah.
For instance, it's too much. You know,
okay, I've got the idea. If I understand you correctly, you're an oversensitive person. Is that right, in terms of remedies?
No, I don't consider myself oversensitive, but I found that, you know, say I started on a 200C with a remedy.
Yeah.
I can feel for myself it's too much. I'm oversensitive.
Too much, yes. So you're sensitive to remedies, to some remedies, and they act too strongly. I would go to a low potency and also lower, dilute the dose more. You know, there are people that are hypersensitive to remedies, and if they even just look at the bottle, they're already doing approving. And in that case, you know, just go to a 30, go to a 12C, take one pellet, put it in a 1 liter bottle of water, give it a shake and give them one teaspoon or something like that, and it'll be less stimulating. I give not only a lower potency, but much less of the dose, and, you know, delicately, and that way we can get around that problem.
Great. Okay, so let me thank you, Jeremy. Let me, before I have everybody thank you personally, let me just remind everybody else that, again, that if you want to get more information or learn more about how you can study with Jeremy, you can contact Denise Workoff at Workoff, W-A-R-K-O-V, at earthlink.net. Jeremy's Dynamis course will be starting up in St. Paul, Minnesota, in October of 2004. That will go for 3 years. Also, Jeremy's books are now available through DHR Books at a discounted price. You can contact Allison toll-free at 866-599-5950. I believe there's a 10% discount until May 7th. And also, Jeremy is conducting a group case on homeopathic symposium. This is free to the whole homeopathic community, and that's something you want to probably check out. And also, you can get Jeremy's email if you want to correspond with him about his very exciting project in South Africa, working with AIDS patients, by going to his website, www.dynamis.edu. So let me open it up and have everybody give Jeremy a warm thank you.
All right,
Jeremy.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, people. Thank you. Have a wonderful day and a great weekend.
Thank you.
Okay, God bless.
Bye.
Well.
Ken?
Thank you, Ken, too.
Ken, are you there? Hello, Ken?
Ken, are you there?
He's gone. He shut off his phone. Hello? Ken?
now is Teams. I'm at home. I just got your message. I'm sorry I was on a... I'll tell you from my cell phone. I'll tell you that. Bye.